All right.
Why don't we pray? I certainly need it before we start. I've been praying this evening, but let's at least stand and say our Heavenly King. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit, Amen. O Heavenly King, the Comforter, the Spirit of Truth, forever and full of all things, treasure of blessings, and giver of life, come and abide in us and cleanse us from every impurity and save our souls with good blood. Amen. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit.
Christ is in our midst.
So I'm really delighted to be with you. I'm not used to this sort of thing. I'm just a parish priest. I'm not one of these famous podcasting priests or one of these famous priests that goes around and does retreats all the time. And Janine asked me last year, and I said, yeah, I think I know what I'd like to talk about, which is what I'm talking about tonight and this weekend. But then it didn't work because I double booked. And so I'm glad to be here, but I really am just a parish priest. I'm not a scholarly. I don't have a PhD. I'm just a guy. You know, I'm not one of those super learned priests. So if your questions, you know, during the Q&A are sort of like, you know, in the ninth century, I love my Oxford Dictionary Byzantium at home. I don't know. I'll talk about what I'm going to talk about, and hopefully that intersects a little bit with your life. I hope it's not too boring. I know it's kind of late. I hope you don't find these talks boring. I'll start, this is going to be a little bit hard for me because I never preach, hardly ever, from paper anymore, which my wife says I probably should, so that's something. I had a person once who said, Father, you're a pretty good final plan, you just don't know how to land it. You know, so the sort of like trying to find a conclusion. So I did write this out, so I'm going to be reading a little bit of this. I'll try not to just bury my face into this and just read it sort of stoically. But I was afraid of doing this the whole time, just talking to you, because midnight you guys will be asleep and I'll just be on point number one, rabbit trailing all over the place. I don't want to do that. So I'm going to try to be faithful to what I've written down, try not to rabbit trail from that too much. And really, it's sort of one long talk, but we're not going to do it all at once. So we can just sort of stop as we need to. So you really will have to tell me, and I mean this, you will not offend me at all. When it's time to stop for the night, just tell me. We're probably done for the night. I could set an alarm on my phone or something. But someone, feel free to do that, because I'll probably just go until we stop for the night, and we'll just pick up there tomorrow with the two talks tomorrow, because it really is just sort of one long talk. And I'm, you know, seeing how much time I've got, I hope I've got enough material, but Janine assures me that there's always lots of things to talk about, so we'll go from there. So maybe I should start very briefly and explain my choice of topics for this retreat. I've never heard any of the talks, but I know the kind of people you've had speak here before, so I'm slightly intimidated, but it is what it is. I am who I am, as Popeye says, so I'm just going to talk about what I'm prepared to talk about. My interest in St. John Chrysostom began before I was Orthodox. When, as a Protestant pastor, I started reading the Church Fathers, and Chrysostom was a name that was known to me. I think not in this day and age, not everybody's heard him, but people in the church at least have heard the name of St. John Chrysostom, because there's a liturgy, the liturgy of St. John Chrysostom. So it was a name that was known to me, but I didn't know much about him. And if you know anything about him, you know that his writings, even in English, are really voluminous. There's more, ink of St. John Chrysostom's probably in any language that, you know, the Orthodox use than probably any other father, because so many of his homilies have been translated. And this is true even in English. I bought the 38-volume, you've probably seen the old 38-volume set of the Anti-Nicene and Nicene Fathers. So when I bought that, I opened the volumes of Chrysostom, and which is a whole, I don't know, six volumes of the middle section. I gave those books away to your husband several years ago now, because I've got them digitally. So Father Basil. But anyway, so I opened the volumes of Chrysostom. This is, I'm still not even Orthodox yet. I'm reading these. And when you open, of course, there's homilies on this book, homilies on that book. But one of the writings in there caught my attention immediately. This work is called No One Can Injure the Man Who Does Not Harm Himself. I thought, well, that's a rather intriguing little title. No One Can Injure the Man Who Does Not Harm Himself. Sometimes it gets translated a little bit differently, but that's the gist of it. And that grabbed my attention, that title. No One Can Injure the Man Who Does Not Harm Himself. And so I thought I'm going to read it, and I did. And to speak quite frankly, I was blown away. Without getting personal, I just will tell you that that work specifically was something I needed to hear at that point in my life. And we're going to talk a little bit about that that work, which comes out of the same period as the letters to Olympias, as we go through these talks. But that's exactly what I needed at that point in my life. And that work specifically began the process of changing both my thinking and my way of thinking, because they're two different things. What, you know, what you think, sort of ideas you have in your head, right? But then there's how you think. And if you're Orthodox, you know we talk a lot about logismi and thoughts and all these things. So it's not just what you think, it's figuring out how you think and changing the way you think. And that really, this book especially of St. John's, this work really helped me with that, begin to start down that path, and it eventually led me to Orthodox Church. So I am personally profoundly grateful to and for St. John, and my birth name is John. My mother named me John, and my father. But I took St. John as a patron then when I joined the church, so I probably should be called Father Chrysostom. I didn't realize that until much later. He's my patron. I'm like, I'm not going to be called Chrysostom. Being Orthodox is... priests walk around like this half the time is weird enough to, you know, forgive me if you know a Chrysostom, it's a wonderful name. I'm like, I'm not going to change it now, everybody knows me as John. But anyway, that's what it is. So I don't want to spend too much time talking about St. John's life. We could do that, and it's a fascinating life, but there's books about him, and you could learn about him some of the ways, and we've only got a certain amount of time. So I really want to give our attention in this weekend just to the letters to Olympias. And I'm assured they're in the, I think there's copies in the bookstore, and I forgot to bring mine over. It's down in the guest house. But you've probably all seen it. There's an old translation from that 38-volume set. You want to read it for free, you can go online and read it for free. Dr. David Ford's new translation is really well worth your money in the St. Vladimir Seminary Popular Patristic Series. And he translated all the letters. You're not going to find all the letters anywhere else. If you read the free ones online, you're just going to get about four or five letters, I believe, out of order at that. So I encourage you to buy the new ones. So I really want to give our attention to these letters to Olympias. However, as a background to these, you really need to know something about her, right? So you probably know something about St. John Chrysostom. He was a priest, he was a monk, and then a priest in Antioch, and then he was sort of, depending upon which story you tell, sort of spirited away to Constantinople, where he was made the Archbishop of Constantinople in the late 4th century, and did wonderful things, but also got in trouble, both with his with people that should have been his supporters, meaning his clergy, and detractors for different things. We'll talk about some of that later. But Olympias was, you need to know who she is, because the letters to Olympias are not going to make a whole lot of sense, or they might make some, but it really helps to know something about who she is. So I want to very briefly read to you just a few paragraphs from the biography of Chrysostom by J.N.D. Kelly. And these are not my words, these are his words, but they're so well written, I thought, why come up with my own? I'm just going to read you what he says about Olympias. So this is after Chrysostom goes to Constantinople as a bishop. Attached to Chrysostom's residence in Constantinople was a convent which had been founded and was now presided over by the deaconess Olympias, a woman of remarkable intelligence, determination of character, and outspokenness. Of aristocratic lineage, granddaughter of Constantine's Praetorian prefect, Evlavius. She was fabulously wealthy with estates in Thrace, Galatia, Cappadocia, and Bithynia, as well as numerous properties in Constantinople itself. In 385, Theodosius, eager to build connections between his Spanish relatives and the affluent elite of the capital, had arranged her marriage with one of them, Nevridios, the city praetor, in 386. So she's married to the city praetor. I don't even know exactly what that is. But it's a bigwig in city. And he dies less than 2 years later. So Theodosius, the emperor, pressed her to marry another fellow, Elpidius. And as a Christian committed to the ascetical ideal, she refused. She refused. She refused the emperor. Tells you something about her character. She refused the emperor and said that if God intended, bluntly retorting that if her king, Jesus Christ, had intended her to live with a man, he would not have taken her husband away. The emperor was furious. It was against public interest for such riches to be possessed as she possessed to remain in the keeping of a widow, and a downright waste if she were to lavish them on pious charities. He ordered her fortune to be impounded until she was 30. She's still in her 20s. But 4 years later, before she'd even reached that age, so she's in her early 20s, before she'd even reached the age of 30, he relented and restored it to her, her riches, having been assured of the sincerity and high quality of her ascetic devotion. If you won't marry who I tell you to marry, I'm just going to take your money, I'll just keep it in the bank, and you won't have access to it until you relent. And she didn't relent. She just continued being Olympias, the Christian. Henceforth, she gave herself wholly to the service of God and His church, especially the care of the sick and the poor. According to Palladius, a great admirer, she deliberately modeled herself in her spiritual exercises and charitable works on Melania the Elder, the wealthy Roman aristocrat, who in 378, with Rufinus of Aquileia as her advisor, sorry for all the names, had founded a double monastery at Jerusalem. At this time, Olympias' main task was the supervision of her convent, which she had built on property belonging to herself, and which, beginning with about 50 of her own maidservants, soon increased the amazing total of some 250 inmates, all virgins. Unfortunate word, inmate. That means something else to us. But that means nuns. In addition, she kept open her house for visiting ecclesiastics and Christian travelers in need of hospitality. It is intriguing to note that among the numerous guests that she thus entertained and freely loaded with gifts when they departed, and I just was in Russia for 10 days, and this is exactly what happens, especially as clergy. You go to visit a monastery, and when you leave, I left things behind. I couldn't bring it all home in my suitcase. I mean, they just, you know, you go and they just lavish things on you. At the monasteries, it was wonderful. But among the people that she would have done this with were several who were to become St. John's foes eventually. Irreconcilable foes, people who were opposed to St. John. Highly educated, well-grounded in the scripture, she had placed her services at the disposal of Bishop Nectarius. The courtly old man so valued her charitable generosity and found her advice on church affairs so helpful that he ordained her to be a deaconess when she was still in her early 30s, notwithstanding the ban imposed by St. Paul and quite recently affirmed by Theodosius on consecrating widows under the age of 60. So the normal age to be a deaconess was 60, you had to be single or a widow. And I'm no expert on this, but I mean, I do remember this a little bit. So she's in her early 30s, half that age, and he says she's going to be a deaconess, the bishop, not the emperor. As the leading deaconess attached to his cathedral, John must have made the acquaintance of Olympias, this is Chrysostom, almost immediately after his arrival in the capital. From there, from the start, there seems to have developed between them a deep and, as events were to show, lasting friendship, founded on an affinity which was both spiritual and intellectual. Like him, she was devoted to the Bible, reading its books over and over again. Both practiced similar austerities. Like him, she had ruined her digestive system by excessive fasting. St. John had done this. St. John had this very delicate diet because when he was a monk out in the mountains of Antioch in Syria, he fasted too extremely and had hurt his stomach, so he couldn't eat just about anything. She had done the same thing. Her convent was separated from his palace by a single wall, and she was the only outsider man or woman who had the leave to cross the threshold. So without getting too much into St. John's story, one of the things he did when he came to Constantinople was, it was very common when he arrived for the bishop to entertain constantly his clergy, visiting bishops. Many bishops from the country kept apartments in Constantinople and left country bishops, as they call them, what's the word? I forget the name. There's a title for it in the old literature. But left another bishop behind in their stead, and they would come and live in the city. Right? And they were used to being entertained by the Archbishop of Constantinople. One of the first things St. John Chrysostom did when he came to Constantinople was told all those guys to go home. You see why he lost a certain amount of popularity with certain people. He told them, go home. Your flocks aren't here. This is my flock. Your flock is wherever. Go home and serve them, right? So, and then he ate alone. He didn't like to have a lot of people around him. He wanted to read the scriptures. He wanted to pray. He had other things to do. But she was allowed, Olympias was allowed to cross the threshold. Indeed, he took over the spiritual direction of her community. His inspired talks, her unknown biographer records, by means of the divine charity with which they overflowed, set ablaze the love of God in its inmates. In return, Olympias made herself responsible for taking care of his clothes and for preparing his simple meals, which she sent across each day to the bishop's house. There was no one in Constantinople with whom he was to have a deeper or more sympathetic understanding, no one with whom he was to feel more at ease or to whom he was to pour out his heart more unreservedly than this independent, strong-willed, but also intensely emotional woman. So that's Jamie Kelly talking about Olympias. So we see here then a remarkable relationship between St. John Chrysostom and this deaconess Olympias. Both that of a spiritual father and child, but also we might say kindred spirits and spiritual friends. What brings us to the letters of St. John to Olympias, however, are the events in the final years of his life. We don't have time to go into the details of St. John's exiles and the events that led up to them. Needless to say, church scandals, conflicts between bishops and patriarchs are not new to our age. Mm-hmm. You probably know this. I'm sure you all know this, but whenever I have pious lay people come to me and say, "Do you know what's going on in the church?" I say, "Yep." And go read about Chrysostom or Maximus or any of the church fathers. I mean, you don't have to go that far back. Read a century ago, read 2 centuries ago. Some of our greatest saints, you know, and so there's always been these problems. In St. John's time, there was rivalry and tension between the Church of Alexandria and the upstart Constantinople at that time. The upstart. Furthermore, St. John had problems with his own diocese, which led to rivalries and factions. Thinking about one example, which I already told you this. When St. John arrived in Constantinople as the new bishop, there were many bishops of outlying dioceses who kept apartments in Constantinople so that they could live the urbane life of the wealthy and left auxiliary bishops in charge of the churches back home. When St. John came to town, instead of holding lavish feasts for them as was the custom, he told them all to go home, back to their dioceses, and attend to their pastoral work. You can imagine this did not endear him to some of his clergy, particularly those who saw ordination as an opportunity to climb the social ladder of influence and wealth. Perhaps in America or Canada, that seems like a strange thing to say, to become clergy, to climb the ladder. But in St. John's time, this was very much the case. To become a priest or bishop was, because the empire had basically embraced the faith, was to move up the social ladder. And there were very many men who, especially if they were sort of the landed gentry, who felt like they automatically should just be, if they were Christians, they should automatically be bishops, because they were already in this position, and many of them became that. So this was not St. John's attitude of what the clergy should be. So without going into further detail, we can simply say that St. John was exiled because he had come into conflict with the empress and those who had her ear, particularly the bishops of Alexandria and others who were opposed to St. John. Using false witnesses, appealing to the canons of the church when it suited them, judging his actions in the worst possible light and telling outright lies, a false synod was able to declare John deposed, and with the empress's support, have him sent into exile. And immediately after his first exile, I mean, like a day after his first exile, a major earthquake shook the city, and the empress said, "I have chosen poorly," and called him back. But that didn't last long. Her fickle mind changed, and on the 20th of June, 404, St. John left Constantinople for his second and final exile. So the letters to Olympias, of which we have 17, were written during the first 2.5 years of this approximately 3-year exile, which ended with his death in September of 407. So these letters are from this period, right? St. John has been exiled. Olympias, who is dear to him, and she is dear to him, he's dear to her. These letters come from this period. Finally, a few words about St. Olympias and her spiritual condition during this time, which occasioned St. John's letters. In a sense, it is unfair to say much about the deaconess at this time because we do not have her letters to St. John. And if you read his letters to her, it doesn't look like she wrote a lot. But we don't have her words. So it seems maybe a bit unfair to say much. But we do know about her condition from his letters. And they indicate that she fell into a deep despondency and hopelessness when St. John was exiled. So just think about this for a moment. Knowing what we know about her, right? Widowed at a young age, refused to remarry, gives her life to the church, and not just her life, I mean, her life meaning her wealth, which was vast, right? Giving her whole self, her commitment to God, to the church, her material, physical, and emotional, and social sacrifices, all that she gave up, right? And this is the result. Her spiritual father, bishop, friend, is And, you know, you can go back and read the history yourself. I skimmed over it. But he was railroaded. There was nothing right or fair about it. It was church politics. People outside his diocese and people within his diocese, priests and clergy, you know, it was just, it was awful. And we go back, you know, like I said, you can go back and read the document and say, this was, he was railroaded, and he clearly was. So she gives up everything, gives up her whole life for God and for the church. All of this wealth poured into all of this, and this happens. Right? Perhaps we who are clergy and wives of clergy can sympathize with her. Right? We've given up maybe a few things. Perhaps we often feel keenly what we have sacrificed to follow Christ and to serve the church. But to sacrifice all of that only to have her beloved spiritual father and friend sent into exile herself, and it wasn't just that he was sent away and then business went on as normal. Herself and others close to him were arrested, harassed, deposed. So it wasn't that they just said to John, you're going into exile and now everything is back to normal. They found, and there were a group that were called the Johnites. They were devoted to St. John. They opposed his opponents. And they were. Some of the clergy were deposed. Some were beaten. Some were arrested. Right? They lost their properties. This felt like more than she could bear, no doubt. Surely it was unfair and unjust. Where was God in all of this? So this is the introduction. Hopefully feeling this a little bit, right? We're ready to hear the teaching of St. John Chrysostom's letters to Olympias. All right? So that's the introduction. Any questions? Don't ask me a lot of historical questions because I can't answer a lot. But any questions before we move on about background or anything, I'll try to answer what I can. I have to take a drink of water, so really this is an opportunity. Okay, let's move on. In his letters to St. Olympias, St. John is writing to one who has fallen prey to what the fathers of the church often call the worst of passions. You know what it is? What's the worst? What do the fathers say is the worst passion?
Despair.
Despair, despondency. It might sound strange to our ears that this is the worst passion because you talk to most people, they think the hot passions are the worst, right? What's the worst passion? Something to do with sex, probably. Right? Anger. Wrath. Nope. Fathers say the worst passion is despondency, despair. Despondency is so deadly precisely because it is a sort of spiritual paralysis. It's a freezing of our heart. It's a freezing of our desire. You give up. And that's what despair is. I give up. I quit. And it freezes our heart and our desire for Christ and for repentance. I've come to see over the years as a priest, hearing confessions, that one of my most primary jobs, most basic jobs, is helping people to avoid despondency. And if they fall into it, to help them get out of it. So often, you probably have done this yourself. People come to confession and say, Father, if I had a dime, right? Father, it's the same sins as last time, as the time before. I might as well just make a recording and bring it and just play it each time I come to confession because it's the same old stuff. And they say this and they're downcast and they're beaten. And they're on the edge of hopelessness. Why aren't I getting better? Why aren't I improving? Or why is all this stuff going on? Like Olympias. Right? What I tell them is very simple. The very fact that you're standing here in confession means that you've not been defeated. The very fact that you're standing here is proof that you've not been defeated. If you were beaten, you wouldn't be here at least trying to repent. Right? I've had people come and say, I don't even have the will to repent. I said, then why are you standing here? Well, I want the will to repent. I said, then you've got the will to have the will to repent. That's something. You've got something. I mean, it seems like small things, but I mean, really. God doesn't need much. Mustard seed faith, I mean, that's not much. St. John was in a very similar situation with Olympias. She's despondent, she's hopeless, she wasn't even writing letters. We don't know that she wrote any. But in some of his letters, he's saying, write to me. He's speaking in the imperative. He's telling her, you need to write me and tell me that you're better, which means she probably had not. He was in the same situation with her, except that it seems that she, the things that emptied her hope were the external goings-on in Constantinople. It wasn't so much for her sense of her own sins. Maybe that was part of it. But just the politics of the church. And this wasn't something she was reading about on the internet. It's something she was living. The exile of St. John, the arrest and deposition of good and faithful bishops and priests, the harassment of Christians, the apparent victory of evil. St. John, however, had to deal with this with Olympias, not in confession, but from hundreds of miles away through his letters. While this was undoubtedly more difficult for him and for Olympias, thank God, and this is always the case with the struggles of the saints, we're the beneficiaries. Because this didn't happen in confession, it happened in a letter, we got the book. We've got the writings. And so the saints struggle, and we never, you know, and sometimes, you know, our own struggles, we forget this. This is one of the rabbit trails I said I wasn't going to take and go down them very long. But we often forget that in our own struggles, you know, we don't know what's going to come out of it for somebody else. Right? We don't know what wisdom we're going to gain just from this that we're going to be able to impart someday to someone else. Right? So, his letters to Olympias, along with the two treatises that he wrote in exile, came into being precisely to address spiritually the struggle against despondency. So that's really what these letters are all about. These letters to Olympias are really all about despondency and despair and hopelessness. And since we do not have the time to read together through the letters, that would just be better, probably, I have attempted in what follows to summarize his spiritual teaching, St. John's word, right? Abba, give me a word. Father, give me a word. This is his word to Olympias. These letters on fighting despondency. So, without any further ado, let us begin. So here, what I want to try to do now, that's all kind of background, right? I just kind of want to go in, not in, go through the letters one by one. This letter says this letter. You can read the letters on your own. You don't need me to do that. I'm just going to try to summarize the teaching, as I understand it, of the letters of St. John Chrysostom to Olympias. The first point that St. John makes and that he returns to again and again is the foundation of everything else that he says. It is simple. So simple that when you hear it, you go, okay, next point. We know that one already. And yet profound. And it is this. No matter what the condition of the world, the church, and even our lives, God is in control. Stated in a word, this is the doctrine of God's providence. We don't have the time to unpack St. John's argument about providence, his theological reasoning, the biblical basis he gives for it. I assume, as I said, you know what providence is. God is in control. Right? So we don't have time to explore the theological basis for it, etc. I'm just going to state it because it's essential to everything else he says. You have to grasp this teaching if we're going to follow out St. John's argument in these letters, his argument to Olympias. So, in our lives, we often hear something that sounds a lot like this doctrine of providence. You know, God is in control, right? We often hear this phrase, I bet you know which one I'm thinking of. It sounds a lot like providence. Anybody know what I'm thinking of? People say this all the time.
Everything happens for a reason,
right? We hear this all the time. My neighbor told me this a few weeks ago. Right? Not Orthodox. Christian guy, stand in the street, have a conversation, taking our trash cans in, back into each other, start talking, how's your job, not going so good. That's all right, everything happens for a reason, he says. Something better will come along. Right? So, people say things, I lost my job, but then I got a better one. Everything happens for a reason. I got this sickness, sounds like a bummer, but it caused me to slow down and spend more time with my family. So I guess everything happens for a reason. I might call it, Providence Light. Okay, like Miller Light or something. Except that I fear that gives it too much credit. This sort of philosophy, everything happens for a reason, basically amounts to looking on the bright side. Right? And while that might be helpful at times, sometimes we need to look on the bright side, it's not what St. John means when he's talking to Olympias about Providence. A true understanding of providence would say, yes, everything happens for a reason, but, this is very important, but God's reason is our salvation. It's very common for St. John in his writings, not so much in the Lotus of Olympus, he doesn't spell this out, but in his writings, many of the fathers, mothers of the church refer to this life as a sort of gymnasium. This life is a gymnasium, a gymnasium here in Europe, or a boot camp or a training camp for heaven. The English poet William Blake says it in a rather lovely way. We are put on earth a little space that we may learn to bear the beams of love. We are put on earth a little space that we may learn to bear the beams of love. So when we speak of God's reason and his providence being our salvation, we mean more than just going to heaven when we die. Okay? We say something like I'm saying, right? Everything happens for a reason, but God's reason is our salvation. And we might say, oh yes, I know salvation when we go to heaven when we die. That's what salvation is. No. It is becoming heavenly beings now. In this present life. One way of saying this that I'm rather fond of, and if you were in my church, you'd know this, because every fourth sermon I managed to say this. You can't go to heaven. You have to become heaven. I think, you know, we talk a lot in the Orthodox Church, too much, honestly, if you want my opinion, about we throw words like theosis around, like they're, you know, popcorn or something. Right? We say these big words, and, oh, yes, salvation, theosis, right? But so we think, I've got a handle on it because I know a word. What does it mean? This is what it means. You can't go to heaven, you have to become heaven. That's what theosis means. For St. John and the Orthodox Christum, for St. John Chrysostom and the Orthodox tradition in general, this learning to bear the beams of love or becoming heaven means, therefore, as an essential first step, acquiring the virtues. Now, this might surprise you. Okay, you might say, I'm not following you. Track with me. This might surprise you. For many of us, virtue is associated with ethics or morality. Right? Virtue. Oh, yes, I know virtue. And if you know anything, even, you know, maybe you know something about, say, well, yes, there's virtue ethics as opposed to sort of modern deontological ethics or some such thing, right? Ethics is associated with trying to be good, or people say this a lot nowadays. My wife teaches at a classical school. They talk a lot about virtue, and they mean, when you press them, they mean having good character. Right? That sounds okay. But for St. John Chrysostom and for the entire Orthodox tradition, there's a much more profound understanding of virtue and the virtues. In Orthodox spiritual theology, the essential first step to this living a heavenly life on earth or becoming heaven, you can't go to heaven, you have to become heaven. This essential first step is the life of the virtues. It's essential. It's fundamental. Think from, if you don't believe me, just think for a minute. Think about, what's the, after the Bible, what's our most popular book of spiritual literature in the Orthodox tradition? We read it every Lent. We got an icon, we celebrate St. John. Latter Divine Ascent, right. Throughout most of church history, at least, since it was written, the Latter Divine Ascent is like a classic, right? Now, I know nowadays a lot of people don't read, they say that's a monastic book, you're getting in trouble if you read it, and that can be true. If you're not ready for it. But that doesn't change the fact that it is a sort of standard text of Orthodox spirituality. Right? If you look at the Latter Divine Ascent, does anybody know anything about the Latter Divine Ascent? Anybody, don't be shy. Anybody read the Latter Divine Ascent? Okay. A few of you. How many rungs? Anybody know how many rungs? 30 rungs. There's 30 rungs of the Latter Divine Ascent. If you look at each one of those rungs of the Latter Divine Ascent, each rung is either a virtue, specifically, or some putting off of the passion, which is the sort of the negative side of virtue. Does that make sense? I mean, so to gain, let's just use an easy one, self-control, right? Self-control is a virtue, right? But to do that, you got to put away the passion of a lack of self-control, right? You got to be able to learn, like, fasting and other things to control yourself, right? And if you look at the ladder of divine ascent, every step is one of these things. It's all about the virtues. It's all about the virtues. Likewise, if you look at any of the traditional three stages, you know, sometimes it's very common in Orthodox literature, especially literature about the Orthodox tradition, to define the spiritual life as three stages, right? You know this? Are you familiar with this? The first stage is what? Anybody know? Purification. And then the second stage is illumination. And the third stage is contemplation. These different names, and sometimes they'll rearrange them a little bit differently. But this is pretty common with fathers. If you read the early fathers, the later fathers, it's very common to sort of schematize the spiritual life this way. Father Dimitri Stanloi, famous Romanian, one of the greatest theologians of the past few centuries. Romanian theologian of the 20th century suffered under the communists, among great theologian. He wrote a book called Orthodox Spirituality, and it is a rather in-depth treatment of Orthodox spiritual life, and it follows this schematic. First stage is purification, right? Purification of the passions, healing of the passions, through acquiring the virtues. And then you go on to the upper stages, illumination and contemplation, which have more to do with the second stage. We're not talking about this, so I don't spend too much time on it, but illumination means, in effect, seeing God in all things and all things in God. It's where, after having been purified, you perceive the world and you just see God everywhere. Like Bishop Kalasos or Nama Pankas likes to say, the whole world, I don't think I can do that to you. The whole world becomes a burning bush. If you've heard Paul Kalasos, you know. Except he would take you three times longer to say, he's very silly. But where the whole world becomes a sort of burning bush, and you just perceive God. And this happens with the saints. And then the higher level is contemplation. Theory, if you want to use the Greek word. But my point is, the essential first stage is the acquisition of the virtues. Right? Acquiring the virtues, these ways of Christ. So, I realize that this might be new and surprising to some of us who are accustomed, like most modern people, to thinking of virtue as merely concerned with behavior or character. You might say, you know, what's all this talk about virtue? I don't understand why it's important. So in order to understand this better, I want to take a few minutes to look at a few quotes from the fathers on virtue. Because we need to know if St. John is assuming this, and sometimes stating it quite explicitly with Olympias, right? Knowing that God is in control, and having faith in God, which we're going to get to, right? That the purpose of this life is God saving us. Things don't just happen for a reason. They happen for our salvation. What is salvation? Going to heaven when you die? No. Become in heaven now. How does that happen? Acquiring virtues is the essential first step. So, let's read a few quotes from the fathers. Try not to belabor this. I think these might be on your sheet. I just made this handout because I felt like I should give you something to look at. So these might be on the sheet. They don't coordinate with mine. Yeah, this is going to be 2B1 and following. The fathers on virtue. God is the source of every virtue as the sun is of daylight, says St. Mark the Ascetic. He also says, the Logos became man so that man might become Logos. Being rich, he became poor for our sakes, so that through his poverty we might become rich. He's referencing 2 Corinthians 8:9. And his great love for man, he became like us, so that through every virtue we might become like him. Now here, this is very interesting. We know that kind of language. We've heard this before. This is the famous Orthodox definition of deification. St. Athanasius said it. St. Irenaeus basically said it before him, and a little bit differently. We've been saying it ever since. God became man so that man can become God. Sorry, I know that's... God became human so that humans can become God. Right? old dog, new tricks. Forgive me. But St. Mark is using this very definition, but look at what he does with it. In his great love for man, he became like us. He's using this definition so that through every virtue we might become like him. Because we ask, how does this happen? God became man so that man can become God. Like what? Is God really the magic wand? Then how does this happen? Right? Poof! Take communion and poof! You're like God? I mean, no, we know that it's work. Right? It's spiritual work. How does it happen? Well, St. Mark is spelling it out here. So that through every virtue, we might become like him. So in other words, the process of deification, if we want to use the big technical language, or spiritual transformation, is the process of acquiring the virtues, at least in the first stage of this spiritual life. The very first stage of this process of deification is acquiring the virtues. Next quote, still St. Mark the Ascetic. The act of keeping the commandments of Christ and the labor of the virtues which lead down as the rule for this present age are the nourishment of divine glory. Notice, this is very tricky. The first several times I read this, I thought it meant, oh, that's how we're eating divine glory. That's not what he's saying. It's glory's nourishment. The act of keeping the commandments of Christ and the labor of the virtues, which is laid down as the rule for this present age, are the nourishment of divine glory. For I shall love, he says, the one who keeps my commandments and shall show myself to him. And just as sensible fire uses wax for its fuel, so the glory of divine light shines out on those who have made it their own through virtue. So St. Mark is saying something quite remarkable. The fuel or food for divine glory is the virtuous person. Right? It's as if he's saying virtue and glory and paradise are hungry. They're looking to eat. But what do they eat? This reminds me of the well-known blessing of Elder Kleopo, the Romanian elder, many of you are familiar with him. You remember his famous blessing he used to say to people? Have you heard it? May paradise consume you. We think of eating Christ in the Eucharist and perhaps of even consuming the glory of God in heaven. When my kids were young, one of them said to me, Dad, what will we eat in heaven? And I said, we'll eat God with our eyes. And I'm like, what does that mean? I mean, that's the vision of God. I mean, that's how the fathers describe it. We'll eat God with our eyes. Right? But this is what St. Mark is saying, and what Elder Kleopa is kind of sort of saying. It's not just that, you know, we will eat God. We'll consume the glory of God and the vision of God, the vision of Christ in glory. That's all true. But it also sounds like they're saying that the glory of God in the life of paradise itself is fed by virtue and by the one in whom virtue dwells. I mean, think about it. It's just a little blessing. We think, yeah, it's a nice little thing. We bear less consuming. Right? Paradise is hungry. We know this is true if we think about it. I don't want to rabbit trail, but you know, some of the hymns of what is this? Is it Holy Week? Or is it Sunday of the expulsion of Adam and Eve from paradise? Remember those hymns from the Triodion? How paradise was sad. Pay attention to those next year as we're moving into Lent. Pay attention to those hymns in church. Paradise is grieved. Adam and Eve leaving, you know. So, this next quote is long, but it's just really essential, so bear with me. I know this might seem like we're just doing a lot of heavy lifting here. The essence in every virtue, this is St. Maximus Confessor. The essence in every virtue, so this is important, because why? Because we modern people, we hear virtue, we think character, behavior, being good, right? Why do we want to have good character? Because God likes it if we have good character. Nice job, Johnny. Good character. Like, that's what, I mean, it's sort of external to us. I don't want to get heavy. It's like deontological ethics, if you know what that means. It's like, you know, do the good. Why? Just because it's, just do it. Because you should do it, and if you do it, you know, maybe you'll be happy. Who knows? But, you know, it's just, you just have this thought. You just have this imperative. You should do it. How does that work out for you? I mean, it's worked very well. It's not a great motivator. So when you hear about virtue, it's like, virtue, not a great motivator, you know, just be good, Johnny. No. if virtue is just something sort of extrinsic to us outside of us, that we're just trying to keep a code of conduct of some sort, fully, right? But here's what St. Maximus says. The essence in every virtue is the one logos of God. Who's the logos? Christ. Right? St. John's Gospel, in the beginning was the Word, the Logos. And the Word was with God, and the Word was in God. Christ is the Logos. The essence in every virtue is the one logos of God. So just choose a virtue. Let's just choose humility. Right? Humility, what is that? Well, you could say, well, humility is this, and you could describe it. Maybe you could say, well, this saint is really humble. Here's an example of humility. That's all fine. But if I say, but what is humility? I mean, what is it? I don't mean give me an example of it. I don't mean describe it for me. About 5'2", like you said, describe your wife, about 5'2", brown hair, you know, beautiful hazel eyes. She's not here, any person. You have to tell her, is it? No, but I mean, you know, I'm describing, but if I say, no, what's the essence of humility? St. Maximus says, Christ. It's Christ. And you can say any virtue, righteousness, holiness, love, mercifulness, compassion, right? Almsgiving, I mean, that's a bit more like, almsgiving is, you know, the Greek eleemosyne, that means it's rooted in mercy. Eleemosyne, works of mercy, eleos. So the essence of every virtue, and I know I'm just like repeating, like if I just say it long enough, you'll get it, and I hope you're getting it, because this is, there's hardly anything, in my humble opinion, not so humble, more foundational for us Orthodox to grasp, because as I said, forgive me, rabbit trailing a little bit, I said this before, we're really good at talking about deification, theosis, and, you know, people say, I told someone a while back, it was a little strong, forgive me, I said, if someone says to me once again, Orthodoxy is mystical and Western Christianity is rational, I said, I'm going to vomit. You know, I mean, we've got all these caricatures that we just love to sort of put on bumper stickers and put on our car. This is what Orthodox is. So you've got a handle on it or something, right? We talk, and especially, you know, I like to talk about, oh, our saints saw the divine lie, and we've got books on the divine lie, and it's all true. I'm not saying it's not true. But what about where I live? Down where I live, I ain't seeing the divine light. I'm struggling not to yell at my kid. Or anybody, to be honest. I mean, some days. Right? The guy cuts me up in traffic. Or whatever. I mean, you know. I don't live up there where, you know, theosis, I mean, it's just a concept in my head. And the danger is, you know, we grab one of these things and say, pat ourselves on the back with your thoughts, we have theosis, right? While we're struggling, you know, to fast and to not yell at our kids and stuff like this. So if we don't know what virtue is and why it even matters, we're really in trouble. And I feel like, forgive me, this is the end of my tirade and we'll go back to St. Maximus. I feel like we've done the church, the Orthodox Church in America, maybe other people, a disservice by just sort of starting off up here on the super high ground and talking about, you know, Transfiguration and glory and all this other stuff. I mean, I know we have these feasts and we keep them and we should. But in our sort of our teaching should just probably be the virtues, the commandments of Christ. That's where we're all starting. And according to what the fathers are saying, if we don't start there, we're not even going to get to theosis. We're not even going to see the divine light if I can't be humble. Right? If I can't be self-controlled. So, okay. Here is the homily, back to the lecture. The essence in every virtue is the one logos of God, and this can hardly be doubted, since the essence of all the virtues is our Lord Jesus Christ. As it is written, God made him our wisdom, our righteousness, our holiness, and our redemption. These things are said, of course, this can get a little bit heavy, don't worry about it. These things are, of course, said about him in an absolute sense, for he is wisdom and righteousness and sanctification itself, and not some limited sense, as is the case with human beings. As, for example, in the expression, a wise man or a just man. He's distinguished between God, who the virtues are how God is. God doesn't have humility. Christ doesn't have humility. He is humility. A saint has humility. And maybe someone who's not yet a saint is working on it. Right? But it's something that we acquire. God is these things. He doesn't acquire them. In other words, God can't be proud. He is humble. I can be humble one moment and then turn around and not be humble. I've seen it happen. Which is to say that anyone who through fixed habit participates in virtue unquestionably participates in God, who is the substance of the virtues. For such a person freely and unfeignedly chooses to cultivate the natural seed of the good. Having completed his course, such a person becomes God. Here's this language. I mean, so you see, he's talking about deification. He's talking about all this theosis stuff that I'm saying maybe we shouldn't talk about. But he's linking it essentially to the virtues. Right? Anyone who through fixed habit participates in virtue unquestionably participates in God, who is the substance of the virtues. So in other words, if you've got a virtue, you've got God, because God is a virtue. Right? This is very important for us to understand, because we tend to think as modern people, and I blame Immanuel Kant for this, but this doesn't matter, but I blame them. Right? As modern people, we think like this: if I'm humble, God will from over here say, good job, John, good job being humble. And like that's the reward. It's like a quid pro quo. Right? We even think about heaven this way. When you die, you get to go to heaven. Because why? You got enough stars on your paper when you... I don't know. What is it? Right? It's all this quid pro quo stuff. If you do this, God will say, good job, come on in. That's not at all how anybody, any of the fathers or mothers of the church think about it. I mean, that would all be completely foreign to them. This is why even before Christianity, the classical philosophers, people like Plato and Aristotle, most of us, they had a famous saying that, well, virtue is its own reward. It's not like you get virtuous and someone says, congratulations on being virtuous, now here's $100, or here's going to heaven or something. They said it is its own reward. Because if you, and they didn't, the classic philosophy didn't price humility, but let's just stick with humility. Because if you become humble, you've got Christ. No one can take him from you. Alright? Any of the virtues, you've got God. This is what Maximus is saying. So having completed his course, such a person becomes God. That's the language of deification. They become God. Receiving from God to be God. For to the beautiful nature inherent in the fact that he is God's image, he means a human being, he freely chooses to add the likeness to God by means of the virtues in a natural movement of ascent through which he grows in conformity to his own beginning. That's all fairly heavy, and you have to like read 27 books about St. Maximus to really unpack that. We don't have to do that for the sake of what we're talking about here. He's linking, here's what all you need to know, and all I need to know. He's linking essentially this acquiring the virtues as the process of deification. He uses the language of ascent. He uses the language which may be heard of being created in the image and likeness. And the fathers often say, we're in the image, we attain to the likeness. Right? The fathers of the church always make this distinction. They're not, in Orthodox literature, for the most part, those are not the same thing. They're not synonymous, image and likeness. The image is what's given. Any human being, even a monster, Stalin, was just in Moscow for 10 days this summer. Terrible, terrible, terrible things happened. You probably all know this. Remember, someone kept where we think of these, the monsters. But even they had the image of God. Because they're human beings. It's given in our nature. But the likeness, that's something we must strive and ascend to, attain to. And St. Maximus says, and all the fathers agree, this is the process of acquiring the virtues. To go from the image to the likeness, that's the process of acquiring the virtues. So one more long quote, and then I'll stop, because I feel that probably has been heavy. Maybe we'll start for the night, maybe we just want to do some Q&A about virtue. But let me read one more long quote. I'm not sure I got this one on the handout. Is the next quote Father Dimitri Sanloy? No. I think I added this later. Sorry, you just have to tune in. I told you Father Dimitri was a Romanian theologian, 20th century, imprisoned by the communists, persecuted, but brilliant theologian and very spiritual man. He writes in his book Orthodox Spirituality, which is available in English, Orthodox spirituality presents the process of a Christian's progress on the road to perfection in Christ by the cleansing of the passions and the winning of the virtues, a process which takes place in a certain order. In other words, it describes the manner in which a Christian can go forward from the cleansing of one passion to the cleansing of another, and at the same time to the acquiring of different virtues. Thus, a certain level of perfection is reached and culminates in love. This is a state that represents the cleansing of all the passions and the winning of all the virtues. As man climbs toward this peak, he simultaneously moves toward union with Christ and the knowledge of him by experience, which also means his deification. Now, this is the money quote. All that to say this. In the light of Orthodox spirituality, Christian morality no longer appears as the simple fulfillment of duties imposed by God's commands, duties that in this life lead nowhere but only assure him of salvation as an exterior reward in the next life. That's what I was just saying a minute ago. Right? That's a quid pro quo. If you do this, in the next life I'll let you go to heaven because you developed a good character in this world, Johnny. Right? That's not it. That's not what salvation is. The Christian grows in God even in the course of this life because response to these commands, he's talking about Christ's commands, the gospel commands, what we read in the gospel. The Christian grows in God even in the course of this life because response to these commands brings about a step-by-step transformation in his being. He is filled more and more with the working presence of God. Or in other words, you can't go to heaven, you have to become heaven. Right? So, let me see this. Replace this off. Yeah. Let's do questions. That got really heavy.
Sorry, we're so late.
That's all right. You just missed the heavy stuff. It's all downhill from here.
Oh, okay.
Questions? They're too complicated, like real theoretical and philosophical. I'll be like, I don't know.
What was the name of that last book you've seen?
Father Dimitru Stanloy's Orthodox Spirituality. There's a subtitle, but I don't remember what it is. St. Tikhon's publishes it. St. Tikhon's Press. It's probably at the bookstore here because he's a Romanian kid, but I could be wrong. Yeah?
If we're asked to define even the word virtue, other than saying virtue is God.
Right. So virtue. Virtue has this whole prehistory before the church. I mean, before Christ's incarnation. Mystically, there's nothing before the church, but that's another. I don't, you know what I mean?
Well, I would have thought before. I would have defined it as good behavior.
Right. So, in most classical philosophy, virtue is associated with excellence. It's just excellence. So, be an excellent human, and you've got virtue. If you've got virtue, you're an excellent human. The word in Latin, which is where we get our word virtue, comes from the word for man, so it's associated with manliness, but not like toxic masculinity or some such thing. But what makes, you know, a good human being? So that's what it means. And you know, when you, for example, you read Plato and especially Aristotle, you get a whole theory of virtue, which is really quite good and which the fathers use a lot. But here's what really happens. It's really, 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 really important. The fathers say virtue isn't just, again, this sort of ethical or behavior thing. Because, see, even we're modern people. We can't help it because of when and where we live. We hear, like, behavior and ethical, and we just think of, like, codes of conduct that have been given to us that we should do. Why? Why? Because God said so. I mean, this looks like we're parents again. Because I say so. I don't have time to explain why. I just do it because I'm your dad and I said so. Right? And this is... I don't want to get into all the philosophy, but this happened in the high Middle Ages in the West with certain types of philosophy that basically said things are good because God says they're good. And it created a disconnect between God's person and how God is, what we would say maybe like God's energies. God's energies are how God himself is. Right? God doesn't... Forgive me, I'm going really fast, I know. God doesn't get love. He is love. Right? So, when God says... Be loving. I mean, what is even look at the Gospels. Jesus says we heard this, well, we're probably all on different lectionaries, but a few Sundays ago in my church, our parish, the reading was, you know, forgive your enemies, pray for those who persecute you, for even your heavenly Father sends rain on the just and the unjust, etc., etc. So even Jesus' example is this is how your Father is. It's not just, this is the mandate of heaven, be humble. Why? Because God needed to give you something to do. He was bored and he knew you needed to stay out of trouble, so he's giving you some rules. right? This is how we think of virtue. Like, when I was a kid, I always use this example. I was a kid, I spent every summer day at the swimming pool, and there's like 27 rules on the board, and they just blow the whistle. Number 8, wheeling, number 8. I'm like, sorry, walk, I don't know, forgot. Okay. There's like a list of rules. And that's how we tend to think of ethics and morality, and virtue just gets lumped into that. These are the behaviors that are expected of you. Says who? God. How dare you question God? Sorry, just wanted to know. Patristic Orthodox theology and ethics, you want to call it that? It's not rooted in God just coming up with some, I think love is probably good, and or like these things. This is how God himself is. So even Christ's commandments in the gospel are, in a sense, verbal icons of Christ himself. St. Mark the Ascetic said it. Father Sofroni said it. I didn't even include the quote, but I'm here, you're going to get it for free. Father Sofroni said it. Christ is hidden in his commandments. The imagery, when St. Mark uses it, I don't know if this is exactly what he means, but the imagery at least that comes to my mind is kind of like, you know, if you, this is that time of year I was on the way through, I noticed they haven't even cut all the corn. But you know, the corn, you know, if you give a kid an ear of corn that never eaten corn before, they're going to have a tough time. Why? Yeah, take the husk off. I've seen more than one kid, you know, someone meanly give a kid a husk of corn and say, there you go. He's like, ah, it's terrible, yeah. Take the husk off, right? And then, and then you probably want to boil it and all this other stuff. But the point is, the keeping of the commandment is sort of the external part of the commandment, in a sense, is the husk. Christ is inside it. He's in that commandment. And so when we keep that commandment, right, not just as sort of an external rule, God will love my enemies, we find Christ is in there, right? So what happens in the church is virtue, which in Greek philosophy and Roman philosophy is just sort of human excellence. And I'm just oversimplifying things because I'm not a philosopher. That's the gist of it. In the church, in the Orthodox Church, virtue is transposed. Like when you transpose a piece of music into another key or another setting, right? And they take this virtue and they take a lot of things that the philosophers have already said that's all real good, but it's all brought in to the church, not just like, so now we just have virtue plus some religious stuff on top. No. The fathers say these kind of things. The essence of every virtue is Christ. Why? Because he's the one logos of God. Everything that is only exists in him. Everything that, you know, holds together in him. Everything that's true is only true because he's, because it's true in him. I mean, there's not another truth. So, virtue is Christ himself. Sort of like, you know, light refracted through a diamond. Is that what? Or a prism, not a diamond, sorry. Right? You're the scientist, yeah. Not me. But you see the light goes through, right? And you see the different colors. And that's kind of the way it is, right? Christ, in a sense, is the virtues. But And he does just, you know, we can't just say, just imitate Christ, be like Jesus. And that should be enough. But he knows we're weak, and so he says, like this, be merciful. Right? Even if you don't think they deserve mercy, who are you to judge? So don't judge either, right? But these aren't just things that he's coming up with, like, well, we need some rules. So it's really hard because we tend to think of all this virtue and stuff, we tend to think rule. And that's wrong for a lot of reasons, but one of the reasons it's really, really wrong is that rules are just terrible motivators. Aren't they? I mean, come on, you want to really like watch your kids go, like, here's the rules for the day. They just like power down, like the battery just is raining before your eyes. And we're the same way. We're no different. I preach sermons about fasting, I just watch people go. I mean, you know, really. Because we don't see, and don't worry, I'm not preaching on fasting, but we don't see fasting as an essential way of going from the image to the likeness or of becoming Christ. And if we understood fasting as that, and the fathers do, when you read the fathers' sermons on fasting, they say this kind of stuff, but we're not interested in reading sermons on fasting. We want to read sermons on theosis, and I don't know what. I don't know if I answered your question.
Yes, you did. Thank you.
Yeah.
Can you tell us what else you see as you look into the church during the sermon?
No. This? I see. We've got as many babies now as adults almost, or not babies, kids. We got a lot of babies. And I get a lot of the girls, especially the ladies, the women. And I'm like, anyway, Jesus says, and they're like, hush, Father, you're going to wake the baby. I get a whole lot of that. Any other questions? Yes.
So you said that acquiring the virtues is for means that we have to work with God for that. So it's kind of a paradox because acquiring the virtues means that you are not aware that you really are a virtue person.
Yes.
So what means that this process of working with God to acquire what?
Yes. It's very, very tricky because, again, we can really fall prey to this if we just start thinking, I've got to become more virtuous. And especially if we think of virtues like in the way the classical philosopher did. Virtue means human excellence. I want to be an excellent human, so I'm going to do these things. Look at me, I'm an excellent human. Well, according to Orthodox spiritual theology, not if you think that. Because you can't have, and the Father says, St. John Chrysostom says it repeatedly, you can't have any virtue without humility. Any virtue that doesn't have humility as a part of it, when that's another virtue, isn't really a virtue. If you think you're showing mercy, for example, and you're like, hey, look at me giving this poor guy a sandwich. Everybody, give the poor guy a sandwich. There's no humility in it, so it's not even really mercy. It's just, boy, John, look at what you're doing. So, yeah, when we cooperate with God in acquiring virtues, this is the reason, and I haven't said this properly, I probably should have said this another way, but this is the reason why most of the time the fathers just talk about keeping the commandments of Christ. That's really how we acquire the virtues, is keeping the commandments. Those are like essential, they're really almost synonymous. I mean, we could really sort of break it down, so you keep the commandments and then you acquire the virtue. There's sort of a process to it. But when we do it the way, you know, that Christ just says, right? I mean, because you might say, you know, I read the gospel, Jesus never says anything about virtue. I mean, Jesus never says, and I say to you, become virtuous. He says, love your enemy, pray for those who persecute you, show mercy, right? And that's right. He's not speaking, I'm doing all this talk about virtue can be very sort of conceptual. The fact that I'm sort of struggling to communicate it very well is indicative of that. It's kind of up here, and that's the very thing I said we shouldn't be doing, is being all up here. But really, where it touches the ground where we live is in keeping the commandments. And when we do that, something happens, because if we're keeping the commandment, when I keep the commandment of Christ, I'm a person sort of, as St. Paul says, I'm a slave. I'm a servant. I've freely chosen this slavery. Right? When you come to baptism, I did two baptisms 2 weeks in a row. My grandson last Saturday and another child the Saturday before, but the godparents are asking, when it's a baby, the godparents have to respond. You know, in effect, you know, you're interrogated at the door. Why did you come here? Right? I mean, you've all heard it. You know, they're questioned. Do you renounce the devil? And you can't just answer that once. You can answer it three times. And do you renounce the devil? Have you renounced the devil? I mean, it's like we move from the different verb forms that, you know, like, did you do it? Have you done it? Are you going to keep doing it? I mean, we keep asking like three times. And then after all that, do you unite yourself to Christ? Right, so it's this sort of interrogation, because we're putting ourselves, we're enslaving ourselves to Christ. We freely choose that. There's a certain paradox in that, but I don't want to take time to go into that. But there's a real paradox in that. We choose, because God doesn't ever enslave us against our will. So we have to freely choose to enslave ourselves to Christ. And then the paradox, when it gets to the other side of that paradox, that's the only real freedom. So I think the reason that, you know, we grow in virtue, but we don't spend a lot of time, you know, saying, that's why you don't hear sermons like this, grow in virtue, grow in virtue, grow in virtue, because it's a little abstract, but also because we could become very proud. I think I'm getting more merciful. And we modern people, we're very good at this, taking our and I'm, you know, taking our pulse anyway, but I mean, we're sort of doing it psychologically all the time. People tell me this in confession too. Father, I don't think I'm growing spiritually. I said, not with that attitude. I mean, I didn't say that actually, but I feel like saying it. Why are you looking at whether you're growing or not? I mean, that's not what you look at. Keep the commandments. Right? It's much more practical than I've stated tonight. Keep the commandments. And if we keep the commandment, right, if we really focus on keeping the commandment of Christ, then we're like these people who have voluntarily put ourselves in slavery, and then I'm not thinking, have I acquired this virtue, have I acquired this virtue? I'm just following Christ. I'm just following Christ, and I'm learning Christ through keeping his commandment. I don't know if that answers your question or not.
Father, I think you touched on earlier that certain sins are associated with certain virtues, right? So I'm just wondering, like, how do you know what virtue you actually need in your life, or where do you start? So, like, if you're struggling with a certain sin, and, like, in order to get rid of that sin, do you practice the virtue to replace it?
Yes, you do. The fathers talk a lot about that, and if you look at, like, Father Stan Lowy's book, and a lot of our literature, I mean, if you look at even the Ladder of Divine Ascent, and I'm not saying everybody needs to go read the Ladder of Divine Ascent, especially if your father, confessor, or spiritual father doesn't say to do it. It can be a very heavy book. But if you look at it, it's very much laid out this way. You know, if you're struggling, for example, with gluttony, you know, you need to practice this more intentionally. And most of these things we just practice anyway, but it's just that most of us struggle, so we all struggle maybe with different things, and we all struggle with a lot of the same things too. But yeah, to the degree that a passion is just, I don't really want to get too heavy into all this, but to the degree that a passion is just not technically a part, but it's an aspect, it's like an energy of our soul. That's what a passion is. Like desire. Right? It's an energy of our soul. And God gave those to us. Those are good. They're all natural, the passions. Right? What happens is when they become aimed at the wrong thing, misaligned, or we love the wrong thing, or we desire the wrong thing, or too much of a good thing, or whatever, then what the fathers tend to call passions develop. So we mean two things when we say passion. We just mean sort of the capacity in our soul for desire, for example, or love, or other things. So we mean that by passion. But then often when the spiritual fathers and mothers talk about it, when they say passion, they mean it. They just sort of presume the negative meaning, the diseased passion, the sick passion, the passion, desire gone amok. Right? I want as much as I can get of everything that brings me physical pleasure, right, and satisfaction, and it doesn't work for very long, so then I gotta get more of it, et cetera, et cetera. So yeah, so as that passion, as we begin to keep the commandment and you know, to work on the virtue that is the opposite of passion, you might say, that passion is healed. So there's a process, and I don't want to get too technical, but Father Stan Lowy talks a lot about this, St. Maximus does too. The process is, you know, we never sort of, and this is another maybe way that we think probably, maybe you guys do this, I do this, I used to do this at least. We just sort of, we often think that the good is sort of like zero, like I'm a negative, but I just gotta get back to zero, right? But that's not the way it works in spiritual life. The Father will say, for example, you can't stand still. If you're not moving forward, you're moving backward. If you're not actively loving, you're not loving. Well, what is not loving called? Like hating? If you're not being humble, you are being proud. There's no sort of middle ground where I'm not proud, but I'm not humble. It doesn't exist. That's just like, that's a real conceptual thing, but it's a figment of our imagination. It's not real. So yeah, to the degree that the virtues become part of our, and they're there, I mean, but we've sort of, I don't want to get all technical. The virtues, the Father said, are implanted in our soul. God planted them in our nature. That's part of what it means to be in the image of God. Those virtues are there. They're not something we just make up. We don't have the power to do that. We're created by nature, human beings, with these virtues planted in our soul. But, you know, nature, nurture, and all these other things born into a sinful world and, you know, whatever, we don't always nurture those. We've all known someone who just seems to sort of be naturally humble. You probably know somebody, or people who are just naturally good. I've known people, they seem to be more women than men, but maybe it's just my experience, who just seem naturally unselfish. I'm just a very selfish person, So I notice this when I see someone who just naturally just is like unselfish, just like, yeah, I'll do that. What do you need help with? I see it because I'm the guy that's like, oh gosh, it's my day off. He's going to ask me to drive 30 miles and give him $20. Isn't there some other priest or pastor? You know, that's me. I'm just very selfish. I don't want to do this. But there's some people just like, I've got a priest that he lives near me. He'll just jump in the car and do it. I mean, he's just, and I don't know how, I think he's probably always been that readership degree. And maybe when he was a kid, he just, I don't know. But the point is, right, we are who we are. It doesn't really matter. Where you are is where you begin. That's all you can do. It doesn't do me any good to compare myself. And his name is Father John, too. Mm-hmm. He's a much better Christian than me. He's a much better priest than me. You should have him come do these talks. But it doesn't do me any good to compare myself to him, because I'll just become despondent, right? So I am who I am. This is where I got to start from. But I'm going to learn virtue, like that selfishness. That's going to be healed in me as I choose, right? And through prayer and fasting and things. Because it's not always like direct, like I need to learn this virtue, so I'm going to just do this thing. There's a lot of things that we don't know how they work. And forgive me, I really promise I'm not going to preach on fasting, but I tell this to people all the time, especially during fasting season. The fathers of the church say this. Fasting is like magic. I mean, not magic, I don't mean Harry Potter. But I mean, fasting is really powerful. But we just sort of like, oh. And we just think, well, it just addresses gluttony. But you know, for example, I'm forever telling people this, come to confession, say I'm struggling with sexual lust and, you know, or even looking at pornography and stuff. I always tell them, you have got to fast more strictly. And I'm like, you didn't hear me. I'm not struggling with eating cheeseburgers, I'm struggling with looking at pornography. And I said, and I'm telling you what the fathers say. If you can't say no to a cheeseburger on Friday, you can't say no to the other parts of your body and the other desires. They're intimately and essentially connected. So it gets tricky when we say, well, I need to grow in this virtue, so I need to do this. It doesn't always work that way. Because we don't see very clearly. There's lots of problems here, but we don't see very clearly, number one, how they're all interconnected. But Father Sam always said in that quote, one virtue leads to another virtue. One passion leads to another passion. We know this. Right? I mean, the opposite of what I just said, like a person who says, I'm not going to fast, will probably eventually have problems with sexual things. Because one passion leads to another passion. Right? If you can't say no to this, you're going to be able to say no to this. If this part of your life is disordered, it's going to start to affect all these other areas. Right? It's the same with the virtues. Right? If you start to gain a little bit of self-control, you'll start to learn humility because you realize how hard just saying no to a cheeseburger is. And that's nothing if not humbling. The fact that a cheeseburger can control me? I don't know about you, that's humbling. But I can't say no to a cup of ice cream? I mean, that's humbling. Right? I don't want to digress from that. Okay. So this is part of the reason we just, in the spiritual life, in the Orthodox spiritual life, we just seek to sort of keep the commandments. When we say, I'm a Christian, I'm under obedience, I just keep these commandments, I'm sort of out of the driver's seat. I'm not designing my own spirituality like people want to do today. This is a modern Western thing. We all want to design everything. We all want to engineer human happiness. We want to engineer babies. We want to engineer everything. And we want to engineer, you know, people, I've heard people use the phrase, my Jesus, right? We want to engineer my religion, my spirituality. Well, the problem is, of course, it just doesn't work. We have to become obedient. So the danger in saying some of the things I've said tonight is that we can think, I got to become more virtuous, so I got to work on this virtue. Well, it doesn't exactly work that way. We keep the commandments, right? We keep the commandments. If you try to keep the commandments of Christ and live according to the teaching of the church, fast, pray, give alms, be merciful, love even your enemies, all these other things. In other words, just try to be a Christian, right? But try to really do it. Your passions will emerge. My passion, you'll just find out, you know. And the things that will cure that are maybe not the things that we think will cure it. So, it's really important that we not try to become our own spiritual fathers and mothers. Right? I don't know who said it, but I heard it said a long time ago and I've repeated it many, many times. The person who has himself as a spiritual father has a terrible spiritual father. When I went to seminary, I was so new to the faith. This is really, I know, pretty abnormal. Normally you convert, and if you're going to be sent to the seminary, it would be like 5 years later. But for whatever reason, I was sent 3 months later. And it's not, there's nothing special about me, believe me. It was just the opposite, honestly. My priest that brought me into church was relocated, he was transferred. We were living right near here, and he was afraid, and the church we were attending wasn't sent a priest right away, and he was afraid because I was getting myself into trouble. I was like reading Philip Kalia's and all this other stuff. And he's like, stop reading that. I'm like, why? I went to seminary. I'm a smart guy. Can I read this stuff? He's like, you're not. And he would tell me things like, you're reading, you know, spiritual graduate school stuff, and you're in kindergarten. Right? But I didn't know anything about humility. I mean, so I'm like, so I think he sent me to seminary just because I was going to get myself in trouble if he didn't. Anyway, when I got to seminary, having, you know, made all of about probably 4 confessions in my life, I'm sent to seminary. And now Metropolitan Tikhon, our Metropolitan was Father Tikhon at the time. So I made an appointment with him. Because when you come to seminary, you have to have a spiritual father as a seminarian. And you have to say, this is my spiritual father. They write it down and, you know, they won't be able to find out about you. I mean, not revealing your confessions, obviously, but they need to know that you're going to confession. So I was like, how do I choose a spiritual father? I just don't know. So I went to Father Tikhon, then Father Tikhon, and I asked him, how do I choose a spiritual father? And I start saying, this is my personality, and blah, blah. And he starts laughing, not rudely. You just have to know Father Tikhon, because he's not rude at all. But he can be, in his very humble way, a little bit direct, and he said, the most important thing is that you be a good spiritual child. Not that you find the right spiritual father. You know? So I'm telling that story simply to say it's very easy for us in our modern culture to think that we are in charge of our spiritual life. And we're not. I mean, we have to be obedient, we have to keep commandments, we have to fast, we have to do all those things. But it's really important that we not begin to think that this is something we're engineering. I don't know if that makes any sense. I hope it does. It would just be very easy, with all the stuff I said about virtue, it would be very easy to sort of turn it into that, a new program that I have to undertake, and it really can't be that. It really is about commandments.
Thank you, Father John.
All right.